So thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. I know you just came for a donut and letting me sit down. So my name is Dan Sterling. A lot of you know me. Some of you might not. I teach at the school. I teach a lot of history and PE and religion, a few other things. And so it's kind of fun to talk to the older crowd. It's a little bit older than the middle schoolers I have. And see how it's received from a different generation, perhaps, or a couple generations. So I'm glad you're here. Thank you so much. This is going to be a three-part, perhaps four, depending on how we move through stuff. But I think it's today, next Sunday, and then there's a Bible blast off, right? Which we won't meet. That's the 17th, right?
Yeah.
So it's the 3rd, the 10th, and the 24th. And we'll see how we're doing on the 24th to see if we need a fourth session. Three is plenty, probably. But we're going to talk about what I talk to my students a lot about is God's fingerprints in history. And, of course, you know, I'm not comparing God to a criminal at all. But if there's a crime scene, you know, if you want to find out who's responsible, you dust for fingerprints. Now, God's not doing anything bad, robbing any banks or anything. But when you study history, you can see who's responsible. And as I teach many years, it seems like the more I teach, the more I study, the more I find. The more fingerprints of God I see. And when I take our students to Washington, D.C., like we did this summer, Katie and I and some other fun people, we talk about God sightings in government, in history, in the monuments. And so as I'm teaching history, there is just innumerable God sightings and mentions of, you know, God had to be responsible for this. There's no way this happens without God's direction. That's kind of where we're headed. So this is about how God has directed history and impacted and often intervened in historical events. There are no accidents in history. It is truly his story. It's God's story. It's the story of his people, his direction. And as Christians, oftentimes, we try to avoid using the word luck. Oh, that was lucky. Or these guys were awfully lucky. You know, as Christians, we think God has his hand in just about everything. And of course, sinful man goes sideways and backwards and does... we do our best to mess up God's plan. But in the big picture, it's his story, and he's responsible for all that happens. But you have to be careful, because sin does mess things up, and sin causes tragedy, and sin causes things that, you know, somebody who doesn't really understand how God works might say, why would God do that? Why would God allow that? Well, it's sin that allows these tragic things to happen. But in so many circumstances, more than I have time to mention, God still is present in those tragedies and brings blessings through those tragedies. And sometimes he just flat out intervenes. So I do want to make this a Bible class, not just a history class. In Proverbs, written by King Solomon, I think he's talking about himself here. Lawton, tell me if you think I'm on the right track here. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He bends it wherever he will. I think Solomon recognized that what I do in my rule and what my armies do, it's just God's river. And he bends my river and my heart anywhere he will. Even the decisions of rulers are ultimately under God's direction, even though rulers can mess things up. So, I thought about doing this more chronological, but I decided just to shake it up. So we're not going to start at the beginning. We're going to start with some astronauts. I remember when I don't remember that well. I was 6 years old when man landed on the moon, and I don't remember watching it on TV. I'm still really ticked off at my dad about that. I've asked him many times, I've said, Dad, where was I? Were you watching the moon landing? Oh, yeah. Where was I? Was I there? He says, well, I tried to sit you down on the couch, but you wouldn't stay, and so I gave up. And I go, oh,
Dad.
A few years later, I got into it, and I did get in trouble in school one time. Me and a friend were on the floor under our desks playing astronaut, and I got in big trouble. So I was always from a child really interested in this whole moon program. And of course, obviously Apollo 11 is what everybody, you know, thinks about, the guys walking on the moon. But I think the story of Apollo 8 is almost as remarkable, maybe in some ways more remarkable, because the crew of Apollo 8 was Frank Borman and Jim Lovell and William Anders. Borman's kind of a famous astronaut. Jim Lovell was the Apollo 13 commander, and so it's kind of a star-studded group. They were the first, now think about this, they were the first to leave the Earth and go someplace else in the history of man. Apollo 11 went to the moon, but there was a couple missions that had already gone to the moon. They didn't land. So Apollo 8 were the first three men in history that went some other place, left the gravitational bonds of Earth and went somewhere 300,000 miles away. They were the first to leave, just go somewhere else. They did 10 laps around the moon, and they took awesome pictures like this one. Those pictures of the Earth, like the big blue and green ball that you see in your history book, or yeah, science books probably, those were taken by the astronauts of Apollo 8. And on Christmas Eve, 1968, the Apollo 8 astronauts are the first to ever see the Earth's full majesty and beauty from space. They were so awestruck by the sight that they felt moved to read a portion of the creation account from Genesis. They were the first to see the entire Earth God created and could not pull their eyes away. They took the first photos of Earth that appear in our science books. So can you imagine being those astronauts and seeing the Earth from hundreds of thousands of miles away? They were so moved that they decided to read from Genesis. So I'm going to show you this. This is really spectacular.
For all the people back on Earth, crew of Apollo 8 has a message we would like to send to you.
God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep.
And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God said, "Let there be light."
And there was light. God saw the light, that it was good. God divided the light from the darkness.
God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day.
And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters." And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven.
The evening and the morning were the second day.
Listen to what he says at the end. It's kind of cool.
And God said, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together under one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so.
And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called the sea. And God saw that it was good.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
Because God said it was good a number of times. Fix this here. Hang on a second. Oh, that's not it. So, seeing the Earth from a distance just moved them to consider what God had created and how good and how beautiful it was. Yes, sir?
You know, Dan, that stands in stark contrast with the first Soviet
up in space, they said, over here, God's not up here. He's not in heaven, which very naively, scoffingly proclaimed, illustrates the difference between the communist creed and Christian.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. That's so true. There's a little bit more about Apollo 8 that I wanted to share. So this is just a little bit of side history, a little bit. But 1968, I don't know how many of you remember 1968, but it's often referred to as perhaps the most tumultuous year in American history. Some even say the worst year in American history. I think there's probably worse years. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. There were race riots in major cities. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. The Tet Offensive was the worst part of the Vietnam experience. Violent communist crackdowns in Czechoslovakia. Violence at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. North Korea takes American POWs. Students protest on college campuses. And the Cardinals lose the World Series. Bad year. Anyway, here's a photo of the Lorraine Hotel where Dr. King was assassinated. But this 1968, so they did that reading of Genesis on Christmas Eve. They came back a couple of days later, and just to consider that this year was a rough year, and listen to what happens on the way home. This is kind of cool.
Following Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Received a number of congratulatory telegrams in the past few hours, and if you don't mind, I'd like to read a couple to you.
That sounds good. Go ahead.
Here's one that reads, congratulations on one of the greatest achievements made by man. You have turned into reality the dream of Robert Goddard. And it's signed Charles Lindbergh and Ann Mara Lindbergh. This one is addressed to Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders. Good luck and Godspeed. And it's from Lyndon Baines Johnson. And you got one from the Mrs. Valerie Pringle. I'm sure it's not a name that any of you recognize. It's just a telegram that one of the public affairs officials at NASA picked up because he liked it. Mrs. Pringle writes very simply, you saved 1968.
So there was a quote there, it's not biblical or anything, but it says, when it's dark enough, you can see the stars. And they were referring to 1968, a dark year. But when things are dark, you can see the stars. And I think we can remember that when things are rough in our lives, when things are rough in our country, sometimes when things are dark, that's when you can see God's blessings. And Valerie Pringle thought that they saved 1968. So, did you know there was communion on the moon? This is a story sometimes people have caught up with. I didn't know this story for a long, long time. But now we're going to walk on the moon here soon. So this is July 20th, 1969. Shortly after Apollo 11 landed on the moon, something remarkable happened. Before Neil Armstrong made his famous footprint and the one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind statement, astronaut Buzz Aldrin, a devout Christian, gave himself communion, Holy Communion, on the moon. This scene was a very private moment for him, witnessed only by Neil Armstrong. The event was portrayed on an HBO TV program called From the Earth to the Moon. So this one wasn't broadcast back like the creation account. But I bet you can guess what happened after Apollo 11 did that. They got in big trouble. Those three astronauts were chastised because they were government employees
And you can't just read from Genesis randomly without telling us you're going to do that. And I'm sure that there were some atheists bugged by that. And so those astronauts were reminded, hey, you're government employees. You're paid by the government. You can't be that overtly religious. But they couldn't help themselves. So you'll hear a little reference to that in this scene. So there's a picture of the flag, and that's Buzz Aldrin, because Neil Armstrong had the camera. So most of the pictures of the first men walking on the moon are of Buzz Aldrin. Not Buzz Lightyear, Buzz Aldrin. And so here's the first communion. This is really neat.
Something I'd like to do if you don't mind. I cleared it with Deke. After all the grief that Frank and the others got for reading from Genesis, I can't be specific, but something I want to do. Houston, Tranquility, over.
Tranquility, Houston, go ahead.
Roger, this is the LEM pilot. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever or wherever they may be,
to pause a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours.
And to give thanks in his or her own way.
Their Tang. First food and drink on the moon were communion elements. I find that pretty interesting. I was at the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C. You guys should all make a special trip to Washington, D.C. to see the Bible Museum. It's amazing. And they had a traveling exhibit. It's not there all the time, but I got to see the little cup and the little flask and the little thing that Buzz Aldrin brought back from the moon. That was pretty cool. Took a bunch of pictures of that. Oops. Can you guys hear the clips from the back? We're good on that? You can all hear me? I'll speak up a bit. Psalm 47, 7 and 8 says, "For God is the King of all the earth. He sing praises with a psalm. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne." So we're reminded that God's reign extends beyond borders. He is enthroned above all. Even the countries that don't honor him, he's still in control of those nations and those peoples as well. If you got a dollar bill, you can pull it out, or you could look up here. So coming up, especially next week, I'll have to tell you about next week. Don't miss next week, because I'm going to try to fire up my time machine and get George Washington to join us next week, and I hope that works out. So you got to stick around for George Washington next week. George Washington has some tales to tell of direct intervention, obvious direct intervention. Now, God didn't necessarily intervene in those moon landings. Well, maybe he did, you know. But sometimes these stories I'm sharing with you are of God's direction, God's intervention, and sometimes just about godly Christian people that interact with our history. And you might hear differing opinions of this from people these days, but the founding fathers, by and large, not all of them, by and large, were very, very godly men. And with a few exceptions, the founding fathers knew who was in control and who they were honoring. And this is the Great Seal of the United States. On one, the head side is the eagle. How many stars?
13.
How many arrows? 13. How many olives on the olive branch? 13. 13 colonies. I was at the White House a few weeks back, and I got to see a Great Seal of the United States with the eagle pointed towards the arrows, because it was from World War II. Back in the day, the seal would be altered when we were at war, and the eagle would face the arrows and then go back. Now they passed a law saying the eagle always has to face the olive branch. But I got to see that seal in a secret part of the White House. On the tails side is the unfinished pyramid. How many layers of stone do you think?
13.
Okay. And the all-seeing eye of providence, that's God's eye directing us. Anybody want to impress me and tell me what annuit coeptus means?
He favors our beginnings.
Nice job.
You want the rest of it? None of us orders the story, and you order the ages.
Yep.
And you got e pluribus unum of many one.
There you go. Nice job. So e pluribus unum means out of many, one. Out of many people, one nation. Out of many states, one nation. E pluribus unum. Novus ordo selectum is, what was that again? That's
a new order of the ages.
A new order of the ages. But annuit coeptus is the one that mentions God. Annuit coeptus means providence has favored our undertakings. All right, my goal for 3 weeks is to bring back the word providence. We need to use the word providence more often. They used to use it a lot. The founding fathers used to use the term providence a lot. Roger Williams, a Christian in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, was living amongst the Puritans, and the Puritans came for religious freedom, but then they didn't really grant religious freedom. And so if you weren't worshiping like the Puritans, they sometimes kicked you out. And Roger Williams went and founded Rhode Island. And the capital of Rhode Island is?
Providence,
because he thought God has brought us here. God has given us a place. Providence, God's direction. And annuit coeptus means providence, God, has favored our undertakings. The founding fathers got this right. Do we still today? So now, switching gears, we're going to go to world history for a little bit. And a lot of you have studied about the Roman Empire or seen movies about the Roman Empire. And as I was teaching the Roman Empire year after year, it became pretty clear to me, pretty obvious to me, that God used the Roman Empire to fulfill his plan. And it's so many instances that it cannot possibly be by chance. Okay? This has got to be his ultimate control. So imagine when you guys were expecting your firstborn, what'd you do? In the months leading up to your baby's delivery, what'd you do in the house?
Room ready.
You got a room ready. Okay?
And if you knew it was a boy or a girl, you might paint it a certain color, and you get the crib, and you get the diaper pail, and you get the mobile. You don't want to bring the kid back, sit him on the couch while you paint his room. The room has to be ready before the baby comes. So this is kind of what God did. God knew he had to bring Jesus into the world to redeem the world as a baby, and he had to get the room ready. The room was the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was set just how God needed it to be for the birth of Christ, the work of Christ, the death and resurrection of Christ, and then also the spread of the gospel. It's remarkable. Consider. And this is in no particular order. They're not, you know, by importance. But Rome is famous for its roads. Every time I drive on my road, I wonder why they have to redo my road every 3 years. And the Romans can build roads that last for 2,000 years. We need to figure out how they did that. All roads lead to Rome, they say. Well, the fantastic roads in Rome, they really, the Romans thought they were building them so that their armies could tool around and conquer everybody. But God had a different plan. He wanted those roads to be avenues where the gospel could travel, where the Apostle Paul could travel, where the legions could travel. Consider the centurion that was at the crucifixion and said, "Certainly this was the Son of God." Do you think he kept that to himself? Or did he share that with his 100 soldiers? And those 100 soldiers went on those roads and spread that to everybody that they saw. So the gospel was traveling after the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's also a vast empire, stretching from Scotland to Egypt, North Africa, you know, almost to India, to Spain. It was a huge area at that time. And it's a vast empire for the gospel to travel to a wide area. Prior to this, you had warring empires and countries, and if Jesus came to the Assyrian Empire, it would be very limited. If Jesus came to, you know, the Greek culture, it would be very limited. In this vast empire, it was almost unlimited where the gospel could travel. This is the one that blows my mind. This cannot happen by chance. The Pax Romana is the Roman peace. Approximately 200 years of peace also aided the spread of the gospel. Just consider, if people are fighting wars, and it's hard for the news of Jesus Christ to get around. 200 years of peace. Now think about this. The Roman Empire was a very, very militaristic empire. They weren't really that peaceful. They valued their army, they conquered, and then just kind of weirdly, there was 200 years of peace in this militaristic, barbaric world. Think about that. The United States, we like to think of the United States as a peace-loving people, the eagles facing the olives, right? In 250 years, we've had like 13, 14 major wars. And we're a peace-loving country. We're not militaristic, I don't think. We're not that barbaric. So how in the world do we go 250 years and have 15 wars? The Roman Empire goes 200 years without major wars? That's not chance, okay? So some audience participation here. I don't think that was a coincidence. So that just blows my mind, 200 years of peace. And that was right when Jesus came, and many more decades where, do you think Paul could have had his missionary journeys if there was constant warfare in that part of the world? I mean, he traveled on boats, the biggest trouble he had was just because he was spreading the gospel. The Latin language was really the first language that was common to millions and millions of people. So God knew, I can't really bring Jesus into the world with 700 different languages. I have to have a common language that could aid the spread of the gospel. That common language was very, very helpful. The traveling armies took the good news to the frontiers of the empire, like that famous centurion. I don't know how many of you ever considered this. Some of you have cross necklaces and things on right now. The crucifixion was Roman. Okay? The Romans did that. That's how the Romans executed people, on crosses. This wasn't invented just for Jesus. And during this time,
The only people in Judea who could order an execution were the Roman authorities. So Pontius Pilate was a Roman-appointed governor. And Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin and all these people plotting against Jesus, they could not put him to death. I guess they could have assassinated him, but then they would have been held account for that. They needed the Romans to put Jesus to death. They needed Pilate to wash his hands and say, do with him as you want. I'll order my soldiers to carry this out. It was Roman authority that put Jesus to death. Now, I'm a big fan of the cross and cross necklaces, but it's really a capital punishment tool. You wouldn't wear a guillotine necklace or anything like that, but, you know? And that doesn't dismiss the beauty of the cross, because we know what it meant. But it was a Roman, a terrible, hideous Roman thing that God turned into something glorious. But there's no crucifixion without Rome and their authority. Christmas! You've all heard it in countless, you know, Christmas services. In those days, a decree went out from
Caesar
Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. Mary and Joseph do not go to Bethlehem without being told to by the Roman emperor. It's all part of getting the baby's room ready. The Roman Catholic Church was really the first established Christian church, and it's called the Roman Catholic Church because it was started in Rome. Peter was known as the first bishop, the first pope, if you're of that persuasion, the first established Christian church body. Constantine was the first Christian emperor who made Christianity the official religion. Think about this, just geography. Easy travel, you got the Mediterranean Sea. You can get to Asia, Europe, Africa, eventually other places. There were the roads. Now think about this, a little geography quiz for you. Is there any place on planet Earth that you can stand and connect three different continents? There's only one. Okay? Panama connects two, you know? There's places where two continents come together. There's only one spot where three continents come together. Coincidence? I don't think that was coincidence. So, the gospel could spread to Asia, could spread to Africa, could spread to Europe, eventually across the ocean. This is one sometimes people don't think about. Before Constantine made this the official religion, there was tons of persecution. You know the stories of Christians being fed to the lions in the Colosseum, and your life was in danger to claim to be a Christian. That seems like God is working against Christianity, but no. Persecution actually strengthens the faith. That happens today. In places where Christianity is persecuted, the people who can stand up and be Christian are very, very faithful people. We have persecution in this country. Maybe not deadly persecution, maybe not people going to jail, but just in your jobs and in your schools, you might face persecution, and you could let that persecution crumble your faith, or you could make that strengthen your faith. And I think those Christians in the early Roman Empire had their faith strengthened by persecution. We talked about the location. Europe, Africa, Asia, and coming soon, American exploration. The fish symbol that some of you have on a car is even something that came from the Roman Empire. If you were a Christian and wanted to converse with another Christian, invite them to your worship, you'd take your sandal and make a big arc in the dirt. And if the other person wasn't a Christian, they just thought you were getting your feet dirty. If the other person was a Christian, they would complete that arc and make a fish, and then they would cover it up. And they would be able to interact together. So the fish symbol comes from the Roman Empire. And so I consider it kind of like this. Jesus came into the world, we all know, at just the right time, at just the right place, in just the right empire, for a very important reason. If Jesus came earlier, the gospel would not have spread in the same way. But God had to come at some time, and God got that baby's room ready. The Roman Empire was that baby's room, and
I don't think it was a coincidence.
There's too many of these.
too many little things that you cannot ignore. In Job, says he makes nations great and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. The Roman Empire became very mighty. And God used that might to do all those things I just outlined. And then what happened to the Roman Empire? It fell. Okay? I don't want to be too pessimistic or worry anybody, but, you know, I think about the United States being a very great, we don't think of ourselves as an empire, but a great nation, the greatest nation on the face of the earth. We have to be careful to not turn our back on God's direction, because if we do, we'll go the way of the Roman Empire. God makes nations great. I think he's made America great. And he can also destroy nations that do not honor him. You see it in the Bible. I was going to mention this, so I'll backtrack a little bit. When you come to church, when you go to Bible class, when you go to Sunday school, you hear Bible stories, and they're awesome, okay? And the Bible is the greatest history book I've ever read. There's so much good history in the Bible, and all that history directs us to Jesus Christ. When you're studying history in school, not all those stories direct you to Christ, but God is still in control of all those stories. It's his story. And there's stories of nations that are raised up and nations that are defeated. The Bible is all about this. The people of Israel were destroyed by Assyria and Babylon and Rome, and God didn't leave them. God still had a purpose for them. But the nations rise and fall. A clear statement of God's control over the rise and fall of entire civilizations. All right, so George Washington's coming tomorrow, but I got to get a little bit German here. So, the Reformation in Germany is, to me, just an obvious example of God's direction. Johann Gutenberg invents movable type printing in Germany somewhere in the mid-1450s. Another thing I saw, a couple of you saw also, was a Gutenberg Bible at the Library of Congress. And it was printed somewhere around 1450, and it's in Latin. It's the Latin Vulgate, and it's in movable type. So movable type allowed for books to be mass-produced in a way that was not previous to that. Oh, by the way, right about that same time, Martin Luther is organizing his, or he didn't really organize, it just happened, with his energy and dedication. The Protestant Reformation happens, oh, wait a minute, in Germany. Now you might say, well, that's a coincidence. No. Why didn't the printing press get invented at the same time? Well, that wouldn't have worked, because then you would have had one printing press. So Johann Gutenberg invents the printing press. By 1517, when Luther nails the 95 Theses to the wall, there are hundreds of printing presses. But guess where they are? In Germany. Okay? Yeah. Is that by chance? Is that a coincidence, or is that God's fingerprints? Luther was a prolific writer. He just wrote and wrote and wrote pamphlets and books, translated the New Testament while he was in hiding. And the 95 Theses, this is according to what movie you watch, but I think this is accurate. He nails the 95 Theses, writes them in Latin, because he doesn't really want to start a big problem. He doesn't really want to start a reformation as we see it. He wanted to start a debate with university professors and students at the university and church officials. He didn't write it in German, he wrote it in Latin. However, his friends came, his students, and read the 95 Theses, took it down off the wall, and took it, guess where? To the print shop, where they printed it and reprinted it, probably translated it into German, I'm guessing, and it was all over the place. And it became a movement of the masses because of the printing press. Right time, right place, coincidence. I don't think it was a coincidence. I am going to, let's see what time it is. I'm going to skip this and come back to it next week. Because George might be here to share some stories with us. Ephesians 1:11 says, "In him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purposes of him who works all things according to his will." This is a clear affirmation that God is actively working all things, including history, according to his will. Now, just for fun. You guys seen Bruce Almighty? So, in Bruce Almighty, there's Jim Carrey and Morgan Freeman, two famous actors. And Jim Carrey's character is bummed. His life isn't going the way he wanted it to, and he blames God. God, why are you doing this to me? So God shows up in this fictitious little tale, and God wants to let him know what it's like to be God. So he gives him all of his powers. You'll see how this relates to history by that caption. I didn't know God took vacations. So check this out. This is just kind of for fun.
Take a closer walk with me. Let me explain the rules.
Rules?
Yeah, you left in such a rush, I didn't get a chance to explain.
Two extra fingers freak me out a little bit.
I just figured I'd get your attention. I did the same thing to God. They hated me for 3 weeks. Anyway, here's the deal. You have all my powers. Use them any way you choose. There are only two rules. You can't tell anybody you're God. Believe me, you don't want that kind of attention. And you can't mess with free will.
Well, can I ask why?
Yes, you can. That's the beauty of it.
That's amazing. Well, speaking of amazing, excuse me.
Since you're through with these, I think I'll keep them. Might come in handy someday. See you around, kid.
Where are you going?
I'm taking a vacation.
God doesn't take vacations, does he? Do ye?
Did you ever hear of the Dark Ages? Besides, I'm covered. You can clear everything up in 5 minutes if you want to. Right? Ciao.
Even though that's just kind of a silly movie, there is some interesting things there. For example, he said, you can't mess with free will. That's why we have these tragedies. That's why history goes haywire. That's why things don't happen the way God wants them to happen, because he gives us free will. But even when we screw things up, he picks up the pieces and he blesses the people that honor him and so forth. And then the funny line I always thought was, I'm taking a vacation. God doesn't take vacations. You ever heard of the Dark Ages? So here's a joke from last year. So I recycle my jokes. But do you know why they call it the Dark Ages? Because of all the knights. See? You forgot.
Take it close.
So back to American history. There are examples of God's direction and intervention in world history all over the place. The Bible's full of it, full of examples. But American history is really, it's easy to find. If you know how to look, if your mind is open to finding God's fingerprints and so forth, you can find it all through American history. Now, this is not just me being patriotic, although I am. It's obvious that God had plans for America. Plans to be a world leader, plans to rescue the world from Nazism or whatever.
He wanted this nation to be great, and there are countless, countless examples of how God intervened, directed, was in control. The Pilgrims at Plymouth, you've all heard of. The Pilgrims came to Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620. The first winter, they nearly all died. Massachusetts was probably not the best place to go at wintertime. They eventually flourished with the assistance of Native Americans, like Samoset, who came, just wandered into there to Plymouth and introduced himself at great risk to his own safety, introduced him to Chief Massasoit, who ended up making a treaty with the Pilgrims, and as long as Massasoit lived, there was no warfare between the Wampanoag Indians and the people at Plymouth. When Massasoit died, it got a little bit weird after that. There was an Indian tribe living there in the area, and they all died of disease that were brought by European explorers that came through the area. And so there was this Indian community there, right where Plymouth was going to end up, and there was Indians thriving there, and then when the Pilgrims got there, there wasn't anybody there. Now, the Pilgrims will tell you that that was God's way of clearing the land for them, which sounds kind of harsh, and I can't say that that's exactly what God was doing, but God did that in the Old Testament. He told Joshua to occupy this land, so I'll leave that up to you to think about, but it happened. This disease happened. Sin brings disease into the world, and all those Indians were gone, and there was a place, a nice place with little brooks and, you know, places that were now cleared by this terrible disease. However, Samoset introduced the Pilgrims to the only survivor of that group of Indians. The young man's name was Tisquantum, also known as Squanto. With his help and assistance, the Pilgrims survive and thrive, leading to, of course, that famous sharing of blessings at the first Thanksgiving. So, Native Americans helping these people, a man named Squanto living with them, showing them what grows and how to survive in this unforgiving, you know, is that coincidence? Or is that God helping these people thrive? The Founding Fathers, just many, many. I had trouble paring down what I was going to mention in this class. But there are two monumental founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. John Adams was a very strong Christian. Thomas Jefferson had a little problems with his theology, but he was also a godly man. He had a Bible. He actually had his own version of the Bible. Here's the bad part. With all the miracles taken out, literally with a pair of scissors, cut out the miracles. So Jefferson was a man of the Enlightenment. He was a man of reason. If he couldn't explain it, he wasn't going to believe it. That was his issue. And that's a big issue. But he was not an atheist. He was not a guy who denied God. In fact, he said, men should live by the example of Jesus Christ. He may not have understood who Jesus Christ totally was, but he knew Jesus Christ was a great example for us to follow. Well, these two famous guys, the second and third presidents, were partners. They wrote the Declaration of Independence together. They were founding fathers at the Continental Congress. Then, when the country got started, they became fierce rivals. Jefferson was a Democratic Republican. That's a weird term. And Adams was a Federalist, and they did not see eye to eye. They almost became enemies. They were fierce rivals. But then, after their terms in the White House, they became best friends again. Jefferson living in Monticello in Virginia and Adams living in Massachusetts, they wrote constantly to each other. When they were old and infirmed and couldn't travel anymore, they wrote so many letters that they became pen pals and really, really best friends. Now here's the fun part. They both died on July 4th, 1826, which just happened to be the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence that they both worked on and signed. Now, a lot of people tell this story. A lot of history teachers will say, isn't that a weird coincidence? Or is it God's fingerprints? I mean, consider it this way. What are the odds? Okay, you can do the math on this probably. I didn't, but you can. Two presidents die the same year? That's a coincidence. Two die the exact same date? Wow. Two die the same date and the same year? Oh my. Two die the same date and the same year, and that year happens to be the 50th anniversary of the Declaration? No way. Two die the same date, the same year, on the 50th anniversary year, and on July 4th? That's providence. There's no way the odds would line up like that. These guys helped to write the Declaration. They die on the same day. Famously, Jefferson actually dies first, a few hours before John Adams dies. But John Adams' last words were, "Jefferson still survives." He didn't know. They were too far apart. But that just, I mean, come on.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
Me neither. I won't have time to finish this, but I'll kind of prep you for it a little bit. The Lewis and Clark expedition is kind of famous right here in St. Louis and nationwide. The Corps of Discovery was the 50-some guys that made this journey. They would eventually have a teenage girl and a baby and some other people join them. But it was a military expedition, okay? So Thomas Jefferson asked Meriwether Lewis to make this famous journey west and to collect young, stout men to make this journey and to report back all kinds of cool stuff that Jefferson wanted to know. And when you really study this story, the Corps of Discovery never should have survived. Not one of them should have come back alive. They were saved by a teenage girl named Sacagawea, or Sacagawea, depending on which Indian tribe pronunciation you like. A baby that the men called Pomp. His name was actually Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. They were actually saved by their dog, Seaman, a big Newfoundland dog that Lewis bought just for this journey. Saved by God's protection. Now, I'll get this started. Let me back up here. Show you something. I hope I still have it ready to go. So I show this to my students. I'm kind of proud of that artwork right there. So the Lewis and Clark, and we know a lot about Lewis and Clark because they kept really, really detailed journals. Lewis kept an amazing journal, which you can find at the library. Clark kept a diary, and many of the men on this journey, they knew this was a big deal. They knew this would be something that might make them famous, and so they kept very detailed journals. And so we know a lot of the things that happened. And Lewis and Clark and their men had many near-death moments. For example, 2 days into the journey, Lewis almost, he falls off of a cliff. Okay, and his dog's looking down like, "What are you doing?" He actually caught himself with his knife. Okay, and the guy's on the border going, "2 days in and the guy's going to jump off a cliff?" But he survives. They had a dangerous encounter with the Teton Sioux. The Teton Sioux were the tribe they knew about, one of the tribes they knew about. They were called the Pirates of the Missouri, and they would stop travelers and steal their stuff, say, "We'll let you pass if you give us like 3/4 of your stuff." And so they were hoping they didn't have to encounter the Teton Sioux, but they did. Near Bismarck, North Dakota, they were stopped by the Teton Sioux, and the chief had his hand on the cable of one of their boats, and the Lewis and Clark and his men drew their rifles, and on the cliff there were hundreds of Teton Sioux with their bows and arrow, and they outnumbered Lewis and Clark a lot. And now, a lot of historians would say this is an example of courage and perseverance, and Lewis said, "Take your hand off that cable," and he points a gun at Chief Black Buffalo's head. And then Black Buffalo thought about his situation and called off his warriors, probably because he didn't want to die. The Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery, they would have all died, but Black Buffalo wanted to save his skin, and so they had this very tense, very dangerous encounter with the Teton Sioux, and they survived.
There was once a nasty hailstorm. Now think about this. We think hailstorms are kind of interesting. We go in the house and look out the window. They didn't have anywhere to go. No shelter. Okay? And the hail, they said, was like ping pong ball size. I don't think that's what they said, but a hailstorm could be deadly. And they all survived. Numerous Indian tribes that considered killing them. They encountered somewhere around 50 different Indian tribes that did not know they were coming, did not invite them, and they come with rifles, and they look like a threatening group of people. What do those types of Indians do with threatening groups of people? They kill them. I'll tell you next time why they didn't. It's pretty cool. But I do want to mention one thing. Of these 50-some guys that went on this journey, only one died. Sergeant Floyd. He died very shortly after they left of appendicitis. He had an appendicitis attack, died. They buried him with the honors of war. But historians believe that he would have died no matter where he was. If he was in his home, he would have died of that. If he was at work, he would have died of that. So the journey didn't kill Sergeant Floyd. A burst appendix killed Sergeant Floyd. Nobody else died, and none of them should have survived. The only fatalities were two Blackfeet Indians that were killed on the way home when they were trying to steal their horses. But when I get through this list and kind of package it for you next time, you'll see that there's no way they survive without God's protection, without God's providence. There are just too many examples. There's way more than five. And I'm going to close here because Pastor needs a moment to share. But before he does that, next week, I'm going to get George Washington to come if he's available. And we've got this story to finish. And thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. So, I don't think it's a coincidence that you're all here and that we have a whole lot of backpacks over here. So this has been Care and Connect. We get St. Paul's. There's been so many service opportunities and hours where folks have gathered together and served here on site and out in the community. Well, we have a ton of backpacks over here that are going out. They've been put together here. I think there's 171 total backpacks. 40 of them are back here. They're going specifically to Bethlehem tomorrow. But we have a vehicle outside, kind of over this way. Bob Grohn is raising his hand, and Steve Simpson. We have two vehicles over there. So, like, if everybody in here, every able-bodied person can grab one or two backpacks in, like, 5 minutes, we have them all out there in the vehicle so we can deliver those. So that's why I stopped you early so that we could care and connect together on the way out of the car. And they're all along this wall. So if you guys can grab one or two backpacks as you are able and follow Bob Grohn and Steve Simpson out there to the vehicles, that would be awesome. And I don't have to carry all of them.
That's great, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Grab the backpack.
All right. There you go. Sneak out of the way.